Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
On Tuesday, the Harper government will unveil the fiscal plan that it will carry into the next election campaign. We're expecting the government to be back in surplus and to hand out some election goodies. To talk more about the economy and what he wants to see in the budget, we're joined by Liberal finance critic Scott Bryson.
The McLean's panel sits down to discuss the government's upcoming budget, and we'll talk about this week's developments in the trial of suspended Senator Mike Duffy.
Speaking of the Duffy trial, we'll also be checking in with the people of the senator's home province of PEI. We'll find out how closely Islanders are following the case and what they feel about the trial so far.
And we talked to McLean's political editor, Paul Wells, who is in Alberta covering the provincial election. He'll speak about the PC efforts to keep power and the surprising rise in support for the Wild Rose and NDP.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. On Tuesday, Canadians will finally get a look at the Harper government's fiscal plan as Finance Minister Joe Oliver presents his first budget. Minister Oliver is entering center stage, but delivering his budget later than usual after the plunging price of oil threw off his planning. After seven straight years of deficit budgets, the Conservatives say they will buck the trend this time and be back in the black just in time for the upcoming federal election in October.
Of course, the tax measures and spending in the plan will be appearing in the Conservative election platform when the writ is dropped. Liberal MP Scott Bryson, Justin Trudeau's finance critic, gave us a preview of how the Liberals will attack Oliver's budget in a key speech at Toronto's Canadian Club on Friday. McLean's Auto Bureau Chief John Geddes caught up with Bryson by phone to talk about that speech and next week's budget.
A big, interesting day for you. You've delivered an important speech at the Canadian Club in Toronto, sort of setting the stage for the budget. I want to ask you a bunch of questions about that, but could I start by saying you had some fun at Finance Minister Oliver's expense here, pointing out that he'd run a string of deficits, seven of them, but now wants to pass balanced budget legislation, and it is, I think, the incongruity is obvious. But could I ask, weren't Liberals broadly supportive back in 2009 when the Harper government went deep into deficit to combat the recession? Isn't there sort of a point here about the fact that these were deficits that were rung up in the cause of fighting a slump?
Actually, the Harper government inherited the best fiscal situation of any incoming government in the history of Canada with a $13 billion surplus. It actually, through its spending and tax policies, put Canada into deficit by the autumn of 2008, even before the global financial crisis. So Harper actually spent us to the edge of deficit even before the global financial crisis, and then proceeded with seven deficit budgets, adding $160 billion to the national debt. The previous Liberal governments of Martin and Chrétien had actually taken $80 billion off the national debt. But that's really important, John, that people realize that before the financial crisis, Harper had put us on the edge of deficit. And beyond that, this balanced budget legislation, which on the eve of an election is a gimmick, it's not a policy, coming from this government after having added $160 billion to national debt, it only applies during times of either
he's giving
economic crisis,
like
or
you could run a deficit during a recession or a war, natural disaster.
So during it basically, if you're in recession, you're able to run deficits. Well, if the legislation that they're putting forward on balanced budgets were to be applied retroactively, we'd have to dock their pay back to about 2009, because we haven't been in recession as a country since 2009, 2010. So, I mean, it's laughable that they've already broken legislation that they're now imposing, or the principle of legislation that they're imposing on future governments.
Let me ask about some of the background to what you just said. I mean, you referred to the economic track record and fiscal track record of Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin those years, and I think most people do credit them with having been successful stewards of the public treasury and also good economic managers by and large. But how much do you think it's possible for the Liberals of the current era, the Justin Trudeau Liberals, to sort of run, as it were, or at least sort of claim some ownership of that legacy? Do you think that's going to be part of the mix of the debate in this election year?
Well, First of all, we do have, as a party and Liberal governments, have strong economic records. But we're not running just on that. We're actually building a plan that we will be providing to Canadians, and that is a plan for jobs and growth and middle-class prosperity. The Canadian economy needed a plan for jobs and growth even before plummeting oil prices, and we need one even more today that the economy has flatlined. Hmm. And if you go back before plummeting oil prices, the reality is that the Canadian economy had stagnated, both in terms of GDP growth and jobs growth. We have seen since 2010, in fact, declining rates of growth. Even before plummeting oil prices, we had 160,000 fewer jobs for young Canadians than in 2008. Long-term unemployment, people were unemployed for over a year, the number double that of 2008. Record levels of personal debt, $1.65 for every dollar of annual income. Even before plummeting oil prices, John, we had Canada's growth rates have been lower than the U.S., the U.K., Australia, New Zealand, and so we had a real issue around a stagnant economy even before oil prices dropped.
And you're saying, by making those international comparisons, that this isn't just a reflection of what's sometimes called, it's almost a cliche now, the new normal in sort of Western economic countries, a sort of slower pace of growth in the developed economies, while, you know, the big rates are racked up in the emerging economies like, you know, China and Brazil and Russia, that sort of thing.
Well, there is... We are in a period of what Larry Summers is referring to as secular stagnation.
Yeah.
But what that creates is a challenge for governments to actually, in that new environment, create jobs and growth and opportunities. And it can be done. And we have laid out, in broad strokes, a plan. Justin Trudeau and his economic team have been working hard for the last 2 years, focusing on the middle class, focusing on the need for jobs and growth. And we have been laying out in broad strokes that plan, and we'll be providing more details on that in coming months.
Can I ask about a couple of elements of that you touched on today in your speech? You talk about the need to be bolder, I guess, on infrastructure spending. I think there's been a pretty clear telegraphing from Minister Moore and others that there is going to be some infrastructure spending in the upcoming budget. Do you think it's going to be possible to differentiate a Liberal plan for infrastructure from the Conservative plan, which, although I think you pointed that the timing of it has been controversial in some respects, it's not like this government has ignored infrastructure or not made it a sort of pillar of its policy. How would you hope to differentiate your approach to infrastructure from the Harper government's?
Much of what the Conservatives have done on infrastructure has been a shell game. They say, you know, we're the biggest infrastructure plan in the history of Canada, $75 billion. Hmm. What they don't tell people is that it's back-end loaded. It doesn't really flow until 2017 under another government in the future. And that, in fact, in budget 2013, they reduced by 90% the Build Canada Fund from around $2 billion to about $200 million just to achieve an illusory surplus on the eve of an election. So they play shell games with infrastructure spending, and we'll see what they offer this time. But on the eve of an election, conservative promises on things like infrastructure often aren't credible, if you look at their track record on this. We also have to understand that provinces are broke. Municipalities and cities can only do so much in terms of raising money for infrastructure needs. And the infrastructure needs across Canada are massive.
Let me move to another part of your speech today. You talked about the fact that middle-class incomes have been flat, or there's some debate. We've had some of it on the website of Maclean's about that, but let's accept that middle-class incomes for about three decades haven't grown very quickly. That's a long stretch, right? It's not something you can lay only at the feet of the Harper government. I guess there's a couple of questions there. One is, one of the ways that the Harper government has tried to respond to concerns about middle-class incomes has been to offer some very targeted tax cuts. What do you think about that? I mean, isn't that, I think you, at one point you criticized the government for showering voters with checks on the eve of an election, that isn't a plan. Well, maybe it is kind of a plan, right? At least there are going to be people who aren't going to mind being showered with checks. Do you think there's another message you could bring to middle-class families other than we're going to cut your taxes?
Well, first of all, the middle-class incomes have stagnated in Canada, and they have for a long time. And middle-class families are tapped out with record levels of personal debt. And the problem with many of the Harper breaks, tax breaks, is that they disproportionately favor the people who need the help the least. Income splitting, over $2 billion per year, favors the 15% of the wealthiest Canadians. Doubling the tax-free savings account limit, again, disproportionately benefits the rich. And at the same time, guts the fiscal capacity of future governments, and it will cost future governments billions. The irony...
Scott, can I interrupt for just a sec? Are those then, just to be clear on your policy, are those measures that you would reverse, the income splitting and the expansion of tax-free savings accounts?
Yes. Yes. And we support the income splitting that already exists for seniors in terms of pensioners, but we will not support the income splitting proposal that Mr. Harper's government is putting forward. We think it's unfair. We also believe it's unaffordable.
And you would reverse an expansion, the planned expansion of tax-free savings accounts that we think is coming in this budget, but would you leave in place the existing tax-free savings accounts?
No, we would keep the existing tax-free savings accounts.
Right.
We wouldn't double the limit.
Right.
The people who are maxing out their $5,500 per year, this will help them max out and put another $5,500. But I don't know a lot of middle class families who have that extra cash laying around. Most middle class families I know are struggling.
Yeah.
And we need progressive measures to help the Canadian families who need the help the most.
Some of us in the media are sort of seeing this budget as the first salvo, really, in election season. Do you see it that way? Do you think that the debate that we're going to hear next week around the budget will end up sort of framing the debate that will matter most in the election next fall?
I think the debate is well underway. The Harper government have launched their salvos, and they've drawn their line in the sand, and they said, we are going to, with income splitting and doubling the TFSAs, we're going to focus on our base. We're going to focus on rich Canadians, and this is, they have basically defined themselves in this, and we will see what they actually present in this budget. There will be some gimmicks in there, and whether it's on the infrastructure side, this is a government that is very good at playing shell games. And the other thing to remember that on elections, or rather budgets on the eve of an election, from if you look at the Ontario example and conservative governments in Ontario and eve of election, there are a lot of ways to create an illusory surplus on the eve of an election, a surplus that is not sustainable
structural, as the economists say. Yeah.
And so we are very skeptical of this government's ability to actually balance the books sustainably in a structural way. And there will be all kinds of gimmicks that they incorporate. They would sell the gold out of their grandmother's teeth right now to cobble together a surplus on the eve of an election. But the reality is, for most Canadians out there, they're worried about their jobs. They're seeing their kids, sleeping at home, and their 20-something-year-old kids who can't find good work and are sleeping on the sofa in the basement. They are concerned. The first generation of Canadian parents in our history who believe their kids will be less well off than them. We need a job. We need a plan for jobs and growth. We need to invest in a Trudeau government. We'll invest in infrastructure. We'll invest in people and skills so that young Canadians and all Canadians can get the skills they need for the jobs of today and reskill for the jobs of the future. We will invest in innovation and science and data so that all levels of government and business can make better decisions with better information. And we will invest in rebuilding the important relationships a Canadian Prime Minister needs to defend Canada's economic interests.
That's Maclean's Auto Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with Liberal finance critic Scott Bryson about next week's budget.
Coming up on Maclean's on the Hill, the Maclean's panel discusses that upcoming budget and the latest developments in the trial for Senator Mike Duffy. We also check the pulse of the people of PEI as they follow that case, and we look in on the Alberta election. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill.
It's now time for the Maclean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined as always by my co-host Aaron Wherry, the Associate Editor for Maclean's, and Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes. Thanks very much for joining me, guys.
Good to be here.
All right, so let's start off with the budget. We heard from Scott Bryson just a little while ago, but John, we'll start off with you. What should Canadians be expecting out of this budget?
Well, in one way, this budget is, I mean, all budgets are telegraphed a little bit in advance, right? And this one, we've got some of the big stuff we know. We know income splitting is coming. We know that there'll be a doubling of tax-free savings plans. We know the government, largely through Industry Minister James Moore, has signaled to us that we should be looking for some infrastructure spending, some spending targeted at the manufacturing sector somehow, things like that. I guess the big questions to me are twofold. One, how convincing is the government going to be in its message that they balance the books? It's a key thing for them. They've made it a central thing. And yet, there are quite a few elements of the lead-up to this budget that make it look just a little bit iffy. For example, the fact they had to sell those GM shares. They've done some special one-off things. I don't think it'll be good enough for them to say, we've balanced the books. It'll be better if they can say, we've balanced the books and we've done it in a way that isn't based on a bunch of one-off measures. It's a sustainable long-term thing. If they're vulnerable on that front, then that could be an interesting part of the debate in the days after the budget, like whether or not that fiscal responsibility message is really a full-fledged kind of plausible one or a kind of shaky pre-election one.
I'm interested to see how it shapes up in terms of almost as a campaign document, in terms of a campaign platform. So what are they going to go forward with? What are their big sort of issues that they want to hit? What are the things that they're going to sell to the public? I am interested to see how big of an ad buy they have after this to sell this budget to Canadians through government ads, through those controversial government ads. And then I think the next step then is what the opposition does. Obviously they're not going to support the budget. That doesn't really matter. But what are they going to come up with? What are they going to offer as sort of an alternative? This increasingly puts the pressure on Trudeau to finally come out with a platform. Whether we get that this week, I doubt, but we're going to get that. And so I'm interested to see how things get set up and whether the NDP as well comes in with a couple alternative proposals to say, okay, the Conservatives are offering income splitting and doubling TFSAs. We're going to come back with X. So to me, this is, we kind of keep saying that these are, different events or kickoffs for the election campaign, but this is kind of now, we're at the six month warning kind of, and so how are things going to kind of go from here?
Yeah, and we know this budget will be a huge chunk of the Conservative platform going into the next election. John, do you think that some of the measures that you mentioned a little bit earlier, such as selling the GM shares and the fact that there are signs that there won't be a massive surplus, does that limit the government in its ability to really bring forward new goodies that we haven't already heard about that they could dangle in front of the
voters?
Right.
Well, it limits them in terms of bringing them forth right away. If you can push something off into the out year of a budget cycle, which the Harper government has shown a willingness to do in the past. You announce it now, but then you mention, we won't be doing that until 2018, or something like that. Remember, income splitting was announced in the 2011 election campaign, and we're only now getting a version of that. So they're very willing to put things out as platform items and push them off in out years so they don't have to deal with the fiscal implications of them right away. Just pick up something Aaron said. Normally with a budget, the sort of template around here is the government puts a budget out, the opposition parties oppose it. usually a budget isn't coming this close to a known election date, you know. In fact, I can't remember it ever happening that we absolutely knew the election was coming this soon after budget. The budget is late. The election is a fixed date that looks like it'll be respected this time. So the old convention that, well, the opposition party doesn't really have to put up a bunch of concrete proposals. They can just say they don't like what's in the budget. That'll be harder to sustain. I think there'll be more pressure this time around on the opposition parties because we're so close to say, hey, we're coming into a campaign season anyway. Surely you have some idea about what your alternatives are. So we might see a kind of a sparring of real ideas rather than just a government proposing, opposition opposing.
And one other question for you guys. Do you think the budget is enough to distract Canadians from what's been going on with the Duffy trial? Might work into the planning for the Conservatives.
Crucially important. Crucially important for the Conservatives. In fact, here's a thought. They really need this to be a fairly controversial and hotly debated budget. They don't want to slide this budget down under the radar. They want it in the radar, right? They want it to be blocking out the Duffy trial to as much bigger degree as possible. So again, that raises questions about tactics, and you mentioned earlier advertising. Even more of an impulse then to advertise the budget heavily in the weeks after to try to keep it in the air as the Duffy trial extends on.
And do you think that it will be enough?
I don't think so. I think that the budget will be contested for a few weeks, but I think once the Duffy trial gets to the Nigel Wright issue and the check and the PMO, I would be hard pressed to think what could possibly distract people from that.
And I think there's going to be a little bit of a split because it's looking like, with the way the witnesses are coming up, next week we're going to hear from Jerry Donahue. And he is the guy at the center of that company that the Crown alleges was used to funnel Senate funds through that company to services that otherwise wouldn't actually be approved by the Senate. So he may be coming up next week. So while people are talking about the budget, there is going to be significant testimony. Either it may not be damning for the Conservatives, but it will put a focus on the Duffy trial nonetheless next week.
Yeah, that's interesting. Cormac, you were in there. What should we be thinking about for the Duffy trial? Like, what are the big factors that are coming into focus there?
Well, I think one of the big issues that popped up this week is how long this trial is going to go. And we did hear from the judge this week saying, I don't think we're going to wrap everything up by the June 19th deadline. And because of that, we're now talking about extensions. And at first, everybody thought, oh my God, this could go into the next election if schedules don't work out very well. Well, later on in that day, we did get a little bit of an idea. The judge said, listen, I'm going to clear my schedule in Toronto. This is my priority case. This is what I'm going to focus on. So he's clearing it up to try and get it dealt with right away. I asked Donald Bain, the defense lawyer, do you think this could interfere with the next election? And other reporters were asking the same questions. And he said, no, I think this is going to be wrapped
up.
So
they'll push it into July, maybe, Cormac?
Possibly later in June, July. The judge did mention, first of all, I'll just say it's really rare a judge ever speaks to the media while hearing a case. And because
almost like this case is unusual in some respect. That's funny.
It just added another odd twist to an already very unique case.
Yeah.
But he did speak to the media, which flabbergasted all of us who got a chance to ask him questions.
Yeah.
He's a very nice man. Yeah. But he did say that it's up to courtroom scheduling as well as the other two involved in this case, and that's the Crown and the defense. Mm-hmm. We haven't heard from the Crown. We know they have a couple of big murder trials coming up as well. On top of that, the Mac Harp case, another senator. This Crown prosecutor is the same Crown prosecutor going after Mac Harb over similar charges to what Mike Duffy is facing. And so that's a case coming up in August, and he's got to do prep work for that as well. So I think the Crown schedule is the one that I'll be keeping an eye on when we get to that. And at this point, we have no clue how long we might have to extend.
You've been in the room, but I'm interested to see sort of your take on it. But from afar, it seemed like the first week of this trial, Duffy's lawyer did okay in terms of demonstrating that the Senate's rules, as such as they are, aren't very clear, mm-hmm. and that senators have a fair amount of leeway. This week I felt like it went back into Duffy not looking so great, because now we're getting into the actual details of the things that were expensed. So
you mean like him calling his personal trainer a consultant?
For instance, like, yeah. I thought the fitness thing did not go well. So, you know, we went from kind of having like, oh, well, the rules are ambiguous and who knows, to, well, but, yeah, okay, maybe they're ambiguous, but like, is it really okay to expense these things? I felt like this was not the greatest week for Duffy.
Yeah, it's definitely a change from last week, where the defense clearly dominated. The Crown is now proving some points that the defense is still arguing on those points, that the rules are not clear. Mm-hmm. Subcontractors from a contractor, there were no rules about that. So that's part of the defense. But some of the other areas where I took note was the volunteer work, where people clearly said they did not expect a payment from Senator Duffy and yet received it in the mail. Mark Bury, a journalist on Parliament Hill who talked to him about website analysis and internet trolls, where he said there was mean anonymous crap that on the internet that Duffy was worried about and talked to him about, he said he wasn't expecting payment and yet he received a check in the mail that was actually made out to his wife originally. He said, my wife did no legal work for you, this is not for her, and then sent the check back or destroyed the check, he can't remember, and then he ended up getting another check in the mail made out to him, all from Maple Ridge Media, that company from Jerry Donahue. So I think that's very interesting, where people didn't expect any money from him for the help they did for him, which in other words is they expected they were doing it for
free. At the very least, it looks odd, eh, Cormac?
I mean, whether
you say the defense or the Crown is winning, Duffy's finances, the way he finances his office, looks weird and arcane and convoluted.
All right, thank you very much. McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, McLean's co-host, Associate Editor of McLean's, Aaron Wherry, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
As the Duffy trial continues in Ottawa, we thought it would be good to check in with the people of Prince Edward Island. Duffy, of course, is originally from PEI, but has lived in Ottawa for decades while also having a cottage in his home province. In his court case, the Crown is alleging Duffy's primary residence is actually Ottawa, not Cavendish PEI, and he shouldn't have been entitled to living expenses he has been claiming since he was appointed in 2009. Duffy denies the charges.
So, how are Islanders feeling after 2 weeks of this trial, and how much are they following the case? I called Teresa Wright, a political reporter with the PEI Guardian, to check the pulse of the people of PEI.
So Teresa, first of all, what's the feeling like in PEI? Duffy was a hometown boy who made it big in broadcasting, but now it's an entirely different situation. So what's it like there?
I think people are very much paying attention. It's hard not to when, you know, Prince Edward Island and its senator is splashed all over the national media. And you know, I think Islanders are very engaged in what's going on, especially, as I mentioned, because of the national attention. But in terms of the general feeling, I think that that people are curious to see what's going to happen in court. But there's still this general sense that almost as though it's already been decided in the court of public opinion, that people feel that Islanders feel that he that there are some things that happened that shouldn't have happened, and I think they're just sort of waiting to see how it plays out in court.
How much is it talked about? I mean, are people talking about it in coffee shops? Is it that everywhere you turn, people are talking about Duffy?
It actually is. I mean, I was walking down the street yesterday, just going for a walk, and someone stopped, was driving by and stopped their car and was talking to me out of their car window, asking me about the Mike Duffy case and very much engaged in what was going on with the trial. So I think and all the coffee shops everywhere, people are talking about it for sure.
You mentioned earlier the court of public opinion. Is this just about credibility? What is the public opinion?
Well, I guess when it comes to how Islanders think and feel about it, they have felt from day one as though Mike Duffy they questioned his appointment as PEI senator. There's no, you know, right from the very moment that he was named, people were confused. People were wondering, you know, not that he, you know, whether or not he should be a senator, but how he was the senator for PEI. And then as the details of the expenses scandal have trickled out over the past couple of years, over time there's been a general sense of Islanders just being disappointed and angered by everything that's come out, because I think there's a feeling that Islanders are a little bit embarrassed about how the island might get pulled into the whole perception of Mike Duffy or of any alleged wrongdoing, that PEI could be painted with the same brush. And Islanders are very sensitive about that. Usually we only make the media and in the national headlines when there's something negative that's happening.
So it's the province's reputation at stake here?
I think there's a feeling of that. I mean, and not just the reputation, but what it might mean for PEI. I mean, Mike Duffy was suspended as a senator for PEI a number of months ago, and since that time, another senator has retired. So now we only have two senators in the Red Chamber representing PEI, and we are already a pretty small province in the grand scheme of things. So that's two fewer voices who are able to champion PEI issues and really go to bat for this province at a time when, you know, there are bigger provinces with more seats and a federal election looming. It definitely hurts PEI in many ways.
So does Duffy have any supporters? Are there people out there saying Duff has been done wrong here?
I've maybe come across a handful of people that feel that way. Those are generally people who either know him or know his family. If people are not necessarily willing to jump on the anti-Mike Duffy train, they're more apt to feel as though that they're almost, some people are almost tired of hearing about it. We've been hearing about Mike Duffy and nothing but negative things coming out. And I know the last time that I did a streeter about this, then I did get a general feeling of, okay, well, enough's enough already. He's been through enough. Maybe we should just leave him alone. And I wouldn't really call that a supporters. I would just say that Islanders have almost felt as though, like, as I said earlier, in their mind, you know, the court of public opinion has decided and maybe it's time to move on.
What about the vote there?
Well, it's funny because it's coming at the exact same time that a provincial election is going on. The first day that Mike Duffy trial was the first day of the campaign here. And so I've been asking, you know, the Progressive Conservatives and PEI, you know, how this might be affecting them. And really, I was told off, you know, not to be attributed to anyone in particular, that they have been told, the candidates, to not talk or try not to reference the federal party I've heard from different Islanders who have said if they raise Mike Duffy on the doorsteps, then the Conservative candidate will quickly try to change the subject. So I think that it might have some wider implications in terms of the timing, but it certainly has made for a lot of anybody who's in PEI who's a political watcher to have lots of news to watch.
So it's popping up at the doorstep?
Well, I'm not sure if it's being brought up on the doorstep. What I've been told is that if people do bring it up, they do try to change the subject. And I mean, I can't say that I blame them. As I said, the general feeling in PEI is that something rotten happened here. And whether how the allegations will be proven in court, of course, that we'll have to wait to see how that plays out. But there certainly isn't any feeling that, you know, that there's no presumption of innocence. And so for the Tories who are running in the provincial election, it's a tricky dance for them to have to play, because there was a time when they actually used to bring Mike Duffy in to be a speaker at a provincial party event, or, you know, to be that star person to come in and do speeches. So they definitely try not to. I don't think that they want to necessarily. They don't make any, you know, overly negative statements, but they really try to avoid it.
Excuse my ignorance on PEI politics, but could this really hurt the PC efforts to take power in PEI?
Well, it's hard to get a good snapshot of how the Tories were doing going into this campaign, because we had leadership. We have two brand new leaders, a new premier who just took over from Robert Giz, and the PC leader was elected only a month ago to become the leader of that party. And we didn't really have a poll that had results from both those leaders going into the election. But the Tories were no doubt starting far behind. They only have three seats in the legislature currently. There are a number of vacancies at the moment, as there are a number of MLAs that have decided that they're not going to reoffer. So it kind of, everybody is wondering, you know, what is going to happen. And so, as you know, in an election campaign, there are so many things that are unknown and anything can happen. So to have something like this happening at the exact same time as an election campaign, it definitely doesn't help the Tories.
That was the senior political reporter for the PEI Guardian, Teresa Wright, speaking about how the people of Prince Edward Island are feeling about the trial for Senator Mike Duffy.
Still to come, we check in with McLean's political editor, Paul Wells, who is in Alberta for the provincial election.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Well, Albertans will be heading to the polls on May the 5th with PC leader Jim Prentice campaigning to keep power. The PC party has reigned for decades in the Western Province, and Prentice was seen as the leader to keep it going after the controversies with the previous leader, Alison Redford.
But in the initial stages of the campaign, we've seen a surge for the right-wing Wild Rose Party and, oddly enough, the left-wing New Democrats. To talk more about this, we're joined by McLean's political editor, Paul Wells, who has been on the campaign trail and called us from Lethbridge.
So, Paul, you're on the ground there in Alberta. What are you seeing? What are you hearing? How does this election look to you?
Well, everyone's a little baffled. I mean, because Jim Prentice came striding into the landscape and scattered all before him. Like, he essentially gutted the Wild Rose Party. The NDP had a new leader elected just after he became leader, and she's Rachel Notley, is far less known in Alberta politics. And the Alberta Liberal Party had their leader quit suddenly under a cloud of suspicion. I mean, so Jim Prentice, who has this impressive federal record and is well trusted by sort of the Calgary elites, should be having no trouble. But then he brought down this budget just before, which seems to be too moderate for the conservatives in the province and too harsh in cutting for the progressives, and it's like he's fallen into the crack between two chairs, and a lot of the polling suggests that both the Wild Rose on his right and the NDP on his left have risen up in response to this kind of weirdly dislocated anger about Jim Prentice.
How these polls that are coming out that show, you know, a three-way race, even the Wild Rose Party and the NDP ahead of the Conservatives, how are those polls being sort of treated with credence in the province? Like, are people taking those seriously?
No, everyone I talk to, people who would like Prentice to be reelected and people who are desperate to stop him, and reporters who normally just want a good story, nobody believes these polls. But what they're noticing is that all of these polls, some with wonky methodology and odd surveying techniques and so on, they're showing the same thing. I mean, there hasn't been a poll yet that shows the Conservatives in advance across Alberta. The reason the polls are distrusted is because, of course, everyone bought the polls in the 2012 election, which showed the Wild Rose walking away with this, and then that's not what happened. And so people are a little leery. I mean, in the last 40 years, for most of my life, if you voted for the Conservatives to win the Alberta election, you usually had a pretty good day at the end of it. And so there's a kind of a mistrust of these results. But the leaders of the Wild Rose and NDP parties both say that they're getting really good response at the door. And it is something to watch Jim Prentice campaign. He is the least natural campaigner that I've seen in many years as head of a major party. He's stilted. He's unsure how to finish a sentence. And it's not reassuring if you're a conservative to watch this guy on the stump.
It is sort of stunning that it's come to this, because, you know, a couple months ago he seemed to have had it made, and he seemed to have eliminated his opposition, and he seemed to be doing basically a fine job as premier. Can he pull this out still? Like, does a lot of this come back to ground game, and does the PC party have enough of an advantage in that regard that it doesn't really matter how badly things are going right now?
Well, what the Conservatives are hoping is that in the end, managerial competence will carry the day, and the managerial competence looks more like the Conservatives than like two parties with brand new leaders. Although, unfortunately, the Conservatives have a brand new leader. What he's essentially promising to do is to, over 3 years, get rid of a big deficit that's opened up in the public accounts. He's mostly doing that by holding the line on spending rather than with rapid cuts. It's a very Stephen Harper-esque way to get toward fiscal balance. It's basically taking his time. The hope is that the more people think this through, the more they'll come around to seeing that it's the only reasonable way to proceed. Prentice isn't doing a lot of rallies. He's doing essentially one big crowd event per day, and then he's spending a lot of time doing media interviews and these weird telephone town halls every night, where his campaign staff hires a public relations firm to call out to hundreds of voters in a given riding, and then they spend an hour on the phone on a conference call with Jim Prentice. Well, Jim Prentice has worked for banks, he's a lawyer, he could do a conference call. He's much more comfortable in that sort of quasi-anonymous setting than he is pressing the flesh in a big room. And I think the Conservative Party's bet is that over the course of a regular length campaign, over several weeks, voters will get over the surprise at this odd budget that he brought down, and they'll realize that they might as well stick with him. And, like I said, you're crazy to vote against the Conservative Party in this province, so maybe it'll work.
How is there anybody talking in Alberta about what would happen if Danielle Smith was leader of the Wild Rose Party right now?
A lot of people. I mean, the irony is that she essentially beheaded her own party and took herself and several colleagues over to the Conservative Party. Almost none of them has survived nomination fights, and none of them is going to be a candidate in this election. In the meantime, Prentice turns out to be not nearly the conservative that they thought he would be, and he's opened up space on his right for a resurgent Wild Rose Party. If an experienced leader like Danielle Smith, one that Albertans were familiar with and comfortable with, were still the leader of the opposition leading the Wild Rose Party in campaign, the world might be her oyster. She could be the next premier of the province. But, history's full of people who took bad bets.
So what's your feeling? I mean, is this still up for grabs? I mean, does this feel like, having covered various campaigns before, does this feel like a particular way in the way it's going to go? Does this feel like a campaign that's getting away from the PCs?
I'm always pretty comfortable leaving that decision to the voters in the end. But, someone pointed out that Calgary's not hurting very badly in this election because Calgary's where corporate head offices are. It's the people who are going to keep their job almost no matter what. It's closer to the development tip of the oil sands industry, closer to Edmonton and around there, where there might be a team of 20 who would be working on a field somewhere who have been told their services won't be needed. Multiply that by several dozen. If the investment slows down a bit, Calgary's fine, but Edmonton hurts pretty badly. And the kind of pain that is reflected in angry voters is much more present in the north end of the province than in the south. And so it's possible that Prentice has kind of misread the situation. In his own riding and in the city where most of his campaign staff works most of the time, in Calgary, it's not hurting. And in a lot of the rest of the province, people are scared and angry. And if it goes badly for the Conservatives, and remember, there's a half century of precedence that says, in the end, it doesn't go badly for the Conservatives. But if it did, it would be because there are places in this province where the oil crunch is hurting much more than in Calgary.
That's McLean's political editor, Paul Wells, speaking about the Alberta election. That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.